recognize when we've got a challenge and address it. And I surround myself with phenomenal people. I'm not afraid of hiring people that are smarter than me around me, because I'm not always the smartest person. I have more context than anyone else. But these people lift me. And I think the best managers do that. They just find phenomenal talent and then trust that they are not going to be fighting for your job. They'll actually lift you and show you for the manager that you are.
Welcome to the SaaS Revolution Show, a podcast by SaaSDoc. Here we interview SaaS founders from around the world who've been there and done that. They share the ins and outs of how they built their businesses, their operations, their path to securing investment, and more. Our mission with the podcast is to help you, the founder, learn how to scale your SaaS, maintain your well-being, and navigate the complexities of this ever-changing industry. I'm your host, Alex Diemer, and together we'll explore the good, the bad, and the ugly in the journey to SaaS success. All right, welcome back to the SaaS Revolution Show. I'm your host, Alex Diemer, CEO, founder of SaaSDoc. I'm delighted to be joined today by Matt Well, who is the co-founder and CEO of Muse, also Europe's latest unicorn SaaS and fintech company. Well done, and welcome, Matt, to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really great to have you on. Timing is good, obviously, with the news. So, congrats on that. And I think, obviously, as we talk through and some of the questions on how you've built Muse to this, we'll hopefully paint that picture of what it takes, to build a unicorn company, and probably actually even especially in these times, right? Because not many companies or hardly any are being crowned unicorns like right now in what is a very difficult market. So, any even more impressive achievement on that, and perhaps some comments around that as well. Matt, I always start, and we want the audience just to get to know you a little bit better. So I won't break the trend or tradition there. So I'd love to know, who is Matt Well?
I'm Dutch originally, and I'm as Dutch as you can imagine, from Dutch village, like, typical Dutch family, caravan in the summers to France, and in the winter go skiing. But I think at the core, I'm a hotelier. Like, I'm obsessed with hotels and great travel experiences, and that's naturally why our business is around hotels. But from, I think it was my fifth or sixth, I was five or six, and we went to a hotel in Austria, and my mother could see my eyes open up, like, oh my God, what is this heavenly place that you've just taken me to? And from that moment onwards, everything in my life led to me becoming a hotel manager, which obviously I feared of that path in the meantime, but the love for hotels is still there, very much so.
You must obviously then have great insights in this, not only through that experience of being a hotelier and now having built Muse, right? And we'll obviously share in terms of what Muse does, but like, the clue is it's around hotels, right? SaaS for hotels. A quick question then, and I just thought of this, and this may be my own curiosity, but I'm sure the audience would like this as well. What's the best hotel or your favorite hotel that you've ever visited?
So last year, because I got married, and then someone gifted me the best gift ever, which is a holiday to Aman Hotels. And they're this really high-end luxury hotel, but very private. It's not, it's not in your face like a W would be, like with lots of young people trying to be, really cool. I just really needed to get away from the business. That we booked this beautiful Aman in Thailand. And the experience on the service side was just, I've never experienced that level of service, the training that the people had. And they didn't lose their genuine will to deliver great service. And that really that ruined me for life, because now every time I go into a hotel, which is every week, I'm like, well, it's not the Aman.
Yeah. I guess they say, like, once you travel business, right, it's really hard to go back to economy, and it would be the same in this instance. So good stuff. Good to know. And so, like, tell us then, I guess kind of quickly, what does Muse do, and what's the founding story behind it?
Yeah, so we're basically, you walk into a hotel of a lobby, and then the first thing you normally do is you look for a reception desk, and then you queue up, and then you get ignored by a receptionist who's typing in data, and then you get to the front of the queue, and then they take your data and they start typing it into a system. We hated that. Like, we didn't want that. And I came out of that world. Like, I came out of an 800 bedroom hotel, and all we did was check in, check out, like, welcome to the hotel, passport and credit card, and I'll type your data into the system, and then off you go, here's a key, and go to the room. And when I met Richard in Prague, we were both living in Prague at the time, he was building a hotel, And he was designing it, and he's like, I hate the reception desk. I hate that concept of this big marble block towards really human interactions. And he's like, I'm just not going to buy it. And I'll figure out what I'm going to do when we get there. And the closer he got to the date of the opening of that hotel, the more nervous he got, because he's like, I've looked around. There just isn't anything. And he's like, what is Hilton doing? And I was like, nothing. It's awful. Like, everything is on premise. There's a server in the back room. Credit card data is lying loose on pieces of paper in the back office. It's absolutely insane what I'm seeing. And that was really for him to pitch to me to leave my job and to help him build the next generation system for hotels. And idiots as we were at the time, we were young and we had no idea how complex this was going to be. We just stupidly started building. It's called a PMS, the worst acronym in the world. We started building a PMS, and everyone's like, you guys are insane for doing this because you don't understand how complex this challenge is. 3 years later, we figured out that it was really, really hard. But, you know, we were so far down the road that we're like, let's just keep running at this.
Yeah, no, I mean, great that you've built that. I'm sure, I haven't looked through your list of customers, but I'm sure we stayed at a hotel in the past that probably is running such a thing. I had a really bad experience. I think it was a couple of years ago. We managed to find a window of opportunity during COVID to have a holiday, a summer holiday. And it was in, I want to say it was in Corfu, but it was a 5-star hotel. I won't mention the name. And we'd been traveling most of the day, you know, driving to the airport, waiting, and then, you know, taking the flight and then driving to the hotel because of the time difference, arriving like pretty late. When we got there, I think it was almost like an hour wait to actually like get into the room and all the information that they required and the passports and sit here and have some water and do that. It was like, that was not the experience that I was looking for. And it really kind of put me on the back foot. And actually, I don't think they really kind of fully recovered from there. So,
and the thing is, a lot of hoteliers, when we come in with our story, they're like, oh, great, you're going to automate the hell out of our hotel. And then we're going to have even worse service. And it's like, your service isn't great to begin with. So let me help you automate at least the tech piece so that these people are not looking at screens. But then you need to teach them how to be a great hotelier. Like, we'll give you the time back from these employees, but you've got a job to do to make sure that people genuinely want to create service. So there's definitely this misconception of Muse is going to come in and then we're going to just take out employees. I'm like, no, that's not. I love hotels. I love great service. It's just, we need to create space for that.
No, definitely. And what year did you found the company?
2012. So I joined in 2013. So Richard started about a year before me. And the first idea was really to create this app that guests can use to explore the destination. But he really got stuck once you get close to the opening. I'm like, yeah, but what's the system you use to run the hotel? And that's when we said, okay, ditch that idea and let's go with this idea and really build that infrastructure layer for hotels.
And fast forward to now, 2024, what company data can you share? Obviously, there's some new revenue milestones, new status, because based on new rounds, that's, you know, fresh off the press, you know, headcount, funding, all of that, customers and so on.
We've got about 5,000 hotels live on it today. So we do really well in Europe. You know, if you look at, for example, the Netherlands, 1 in 4 rooms is run by Muse today. US is a big growth market for us, North America, actually. So we're 950 employees today, and we're growing by about 40 people every single month. So we're really on a growth path when the rest of the industry is pulling back from growth. We're actually like, no, there's such an opportunity in hotels. We're seeing and we're grasping. Our revenues have now hit our net revenues because we have a mix of SaaS and payments, and payments is the majority of the revenues. So that we now hit about 100 million net ARR. So we're really hitting that magic milestone that many SaaS companies are kind of aspiring to hit. And we've gone fully remote post-COVID. Like, I was always a believer of everyone in the office, I want to see you. And I'm like, no, that's not clearly not what employees want. And we're leaning into becoming remote first. So these 950 employees, I genuinely couldn't tell you where they are. Like, I know kind of grand numbers of countries where we've got lots of employees, but I actually don't know where in that country people are based. And I'm like, and it's good. It's working.
And you don't care. Like, I mean, could they be traveling the world and it doesn't really matter as long as they're doing their job?
As long as, like, I can legally compliant, hire you in a legally compliant way. So we've got entities in most European countries now, so we can employ people. We employ them through employee records in countries where we can't. So, and as long as we can do it legally. I'm like, great, let's just find the absolute best talent out there. And it also, we've seen a much better diversity now in hires than we were able to do. You know, if I said, oh, in Amsterdam, I can only hire in Amsterdam, you're very limited into the diverse talent pool that you can access. Whereas now we're like, find me a really diverse talent pool, and the recruiters do an incredible job of that.
And you've just announced a new funding round. Can you share what round that was, how much it was, what does that take to your current total funding from the VC side?
Yeah, so we've not raised in that big bubble that happened over COVID because our industry was closed, and we closed our Series C at the end of 2022, which is basically we went to market when every investor was closing their wallets and no one was interested in, you know, investing. And we're like, we need investment because we need this growth. So we closed around recently, but the existing investors are seeing such success in the efficiencies that we're having in running this business and really the space of on-prem moving into the cloud, which is just, it feels like this old story, but our industry is so far behind that it's mostly existing investors that are basically following on saying, run faster because there is such an opportunity right now in this market. So we're bringing in $110 million additionally to what we have on the bank to accelerate the growth. And, you know, we've done a number of acquisitions. We've done 8 acquisitions in the past to accelerate that as well. So this gives us more of that bandwidth to just get more aggressive and making sure that we liberate hotels around the world from their legacy tech stack.
Based on this latest funding round, based on the fact that you guys have just crossed 100 million and are pretty much, unless anyone in the last couple of days has also been crowned a unicorn, are the latest unicorn SaaS company in Europe, perhaps the first also in 2024. I certainly can't think of any others because, as we say, it's a tough market. In the growth market, you know, not many investors are investing, and not many companies are having good enough metrics to really kind of get the VCs to open their checkbooks. So we want to talk about how you've built to Muse to unicorn status, right? But we'll start at the early stage again, you know, thinking about our audience. So really kind of take me back to that first million in revenue. So you were founded in 2012. How long did it take to get to a million? Like, what were the things that you needed to do or did to get there?
Yeah, it took us a long time, actually, because you're building a B2B solution that you're competing with Oracle. And, you know, that's not easy because, honestly, the first 10 sales was us with a laptop walking into a hotel lobby and trying to pitch them to show, like, so that we could showcase what we were doing. And we kept getting sent out of the lobbies. And because we were in Eastern Europe, we were in Czech Republic, there is no funding available. There's no serious VCs in that market. It's changed a little bit, but it's still not at the level what's here in Western Europe. So you're on your own on an island. There's no startup community and there's no VCs or barely anything. And we just kept getting no's. And every time we talk to a VC in Czech Republic, they're like, yeah, stop doing this hard thing. Do this this one feature. And we're like, we can't do that nice feature, like an online check-in. Like, we can't do that unless the infrastructure layer is fixed for hotels. So after 3 years of literally having no cash, like, we got to a point where we hadn't paid our developers for 3 months and we're like, okay, this needs to change. And we're like, right, I'm Dutch. Let's just go to the Netherlands and figure out if we can pretend we're a Dutch company instead. And then once we got our first €1 million investments, which was about 4 years into the journey, that really transformed because suddenly you can make bolder decisions. Because in the early days, when you have literally no cash, it's just me, Richard, and a few developers running around the world doing everything. And once we got that cash, we started hiring a few people and we professionalized to some degree what we were doing. It's definitely not at the level it was at like a few years later. But the first real investor that we brought in was Notion Capital, who came in 2018, so about 6 years in, and they were transformative. Like, up until then, we just got cash from people and we just had to figure it out. And we reached this point where we're like, I think we need some help on figuring this out. We were all just people who had done this for the first time around. Not a single person in the organization had scaled a SaaS business. And then we got funding from Notion and suddenly this whole world opened because in Western Europe, there's just this access to really great companies that you can learn from. And they opened this whole community for us. And, you know, one of the first sessions we had was with this lady, Melissa Di Donato, who who basically comes out of the enterprise space, and she gave us shit. Like, she's like, so sorry, you're the founder and you're the CEO. So who's your sales guy? Like, you, and like, we don't have one. And he's like, well, fix that immediately. You've got to hire. That's the first thing you need to do. And I think those moments that we had, when someone just gave us shit, like, okay, this is not how I run a business. We're like, okay, I think we need to read a few books, get to really figure this out, and hire people who've done this before. And that became the moment when we started hiring. Notion Capital calls them game changers. People who had just done, you know, scaled from A to B or from B to C, and who want to do that again. And that really started to professionalize the business. And then you started getting the traction. But we needed a few of these eye-opening moments.
How long were you leading sales for? Was it throughout this 4 sort of 5 year period before you brought in somebody to sales? And was that person that you brought in for sales pivotal for helping you get to 1 million and cross 1 million?
Yeah, so we had a commercial director who came in year 3, I think, because I was pitching. I was the sales guy to hotels, and we had this consultant helping hotel run an RFP, and he was awful to me. Like, he was literally grilling me for 4 hours about all the things we couldn't do. And then right after we got on that call, he called me separately. He's like, okay, whatever you're doing, I know I'm a bitch, but the system is epic. Like, and I want to be part of this. And we're like, great, you come on board and you run sales for us. So he wasn't a seasoned SaaS professional, but he was a hospitality consultant. So he got what the legacy stack was like. And then he started hiring like SDRs and salespeople into the business. And we started to really learn very quickly what we needed to do.
I guess then you touched on it there. So in terms of your go-to-market motion, and you've now got 5,000 customers. But again, like, looking at the early days, was this, the sales director building, building this team of SDRs, and then building an outbound motion, or like, how did you win those customers?
Yeah, like, I think in the early days, it's, you need people around you who deeply understand the problem, because you don't have a professional SaaS business. So our website I built on Squarespace because we didn't want to waste development talent on that. So our website wasn't doing anything for us. Like, it wasn't generating any interest. So sales initial was all outbound. Like, we had to find our own leads. We had to just do cold calling, etc. And I think if you'd asked me what would you do differently, I wish we'd hired a chief marketing officer earlier, because our website was awful. If I look at today what the website is generating, our entire SMB segment, which is about half of our business, is generated through inbound. The website is a monster that drives so much traffic, whereas we were happy with like 4 or 5 demos a month from our website back in the early days. And that meant our salespeople were on their own. Like, you go out, you just with your laptop, off you go to the hotel lobbies. And it just wasn't a very scalable solution.
At what revenue were you when you hired a CMO then?
It was only 2019 when we hired a professional CMO. So we've definitely had marketing leaders. But again, these were startup leaders who really hadn't built a scalable engine. And we brought in our current CMO, Leah, who had done that for multiple companies. And I remember her coming into the interview and she was like, you guys have no idea what you're doing. And she just gave us, it's a theme of my life. Someone comes in and gives me shit. And it's this wake up call that I have. I'm like, oh, great. You do it then. Yeah. We hired her on the spot. And she's been transformational in the last 4 years for us.
I guess, I mean, that's great. And also, you hired her in 2019. She's still in the role because I think the CMO, you know, it is one of the toughest roles. I hear anecdotally, certainly from a 10-year perspective, because typically they're maybe something like 18 months that CMOs will typically stay in a job, so quite a hard one. I mean, obviously good that she gave you shit and kind of came in with that stance, because I guess what you want to do and what you want to hire people in these specific roles, people that are smarter than you, people that know this better than you, and that can come in and say, look, I see what you're doing. And she was, pretty direct, but, here's how we can do it better. Right. And that's what you want. That's what you're hiring for. So.
And this is the challenge, because Richard and I, this is our first rodeo. Like, that's why we didn't get funding, because everyone's like, you've never run a business. Why would we give you $1 million, $2 million, $3 million? And we're doing pretty well so far. And I think our investors are happy with what we're doing. So
I think so now. Yeah.
Now, right? Yeah. But like, the thing we do really well is recognize when we've got a challenge and address it. And I surround myself with phenomenal people. I'm not afraid of hiring people that are smarter than me around me, because I'm not always the smartest person. I have more context than anyone else. But these people lift me. And I think the best managers do that. They just find phenomenal talent and then trust that they are not going to be fighting for your job. They'll actually lift you and show you for the manager that you are.
100%. And obviously hiring people that lift you and that are smarter than you is definitely a key lesson or requirement in scaling a business. What about, can you think of any others, a couple of lessons in getting to that 10 million ARR mark, some things that you did that really kind of helped you get there?
So definitely the CMO was one of the big things that we needed. But also I remember the very early days when at some point one of our developers said, we should have a product department. And we're like, what's a product department? And we read this book, the Marty Kagan book, effectively. And we're like, yeah, this is what we're missing, because it was me and Richard drawing on a whiteboard what the kind of UI needed to look like. And then we went straight to code. And then we recoded 5 times before that feature really was working. So getting a product department set up was one of the things that was quite pivotal, because suddenly we weren't coding things 5 times. We did it the right way around. So that was definitely one of those big eye-opening moments that we had. At some point, there was this moment of, I had this headache that wouldn't go away. And the doctor was like, yeah, because you work 7 days a week and you can't run support 24/7 for the company. You have to outsource certain things. And it was this realization that you need to hire people to do jobs for you. Otherwise, you burn yourself out along the way. And that's definitely one of the lessons that I'm learning as I'm scaling up, that you have to recognize when you're doing something repetitively that is stupid, you find someone who can automate that piece so that you can step away and step up to the next challenge. So when we hired a support lead who was, you know, building a support function and organization, that was another of those big moments that we had where we outsourced something that was just draining our brain power and distracting us from the business.
Yeah, good lesson there. And I mean, certainly like at our stage, and we're a much smaller organization than Muse, I look at where I can buy back my time. And as you say, like anything that's repetitive, automated, requires a message that can be sent to like 100 people that, you know, I don't have to be sitting through LinkedIn and, you know, messaging each individual kind of person, right? Some like we can find an automated way to do it, or find somebody to do that, so I can actually then spend my time doing more valuable things.
I had a conversation today with our head of contents, like, because we do so many translation work across our business. And I asked him, I was like, how are you leaning into the AI that's available now? And is your team scared? Because I think, you know, if you're a translator, AI is pretty good at doing it. And he's like, no, it's great. We're leaning into it and we're figuring out how we can do more with less people. And I love that he's leaning into that, because I think AI is phenomenal to the people that actually know how to use it. And, you know, they shouldn't be afraid. Like, we're just going to get more effective.
Yeah. And I definitely think it's going to be just such a massive impact in the SaaS and software industry, and really going to kind of help pull us along, you know, for the next 10 years or so, until the next thing comes out. And then look, this is really broad, right? But so let's go. You've just crossed 100 million. I'd be curious to know how long it took from 10 to 100. And then maybe again, like just like one or two lessons. I'm sure again, there's many that really kind of helped you get to this 100 million mark.
So the acceleration really happened in the last 4 years when we closed our Series B. That was a moment when we're like, okay, now we've got motions in place. And that was 2018 when we closed the Series B and we went to kind of up ramping up to COVID. We'd actually really started professionalizing the effort. And then COVID happened and then, you know, it was bad. and we came out of, after about a year of COVID, we were like, okay, no, people, when you're shut down as a hotel, it's the perfect moment to change your infrastructure. So even though we initially thought no one's going to want to buy, COVID was a massive accelerator for hospitality tech to change. So it was about 5 years, I'd say, to go from the 1 million to where we are today. And it's really because we were starting to professionalize the motions, and we, you know, SMB, you know, it's a machine today. Like, I know how much we need to spend on that segment per market and what that's going to drive in MQLs and how those MQLs convert per channel. Like, I couldn't have answered you that 3 years ago, but because we invested so much in our infrastructure layer, like we went with Salesforce. And it was an awful experience because Salesforce is a monstrosity to implement. but we like, we're going to have to get on that platform eventually. So let's just bite the bullet and do it. And then once you've got that layer and you start to really get access to the data, you professionalize the motions. You start to know what a click costs you and how much you should invest in which channel. And it's genuinely machine. Our SMB, we've got about 30, 40 SMB managers, and they just get inbound leads from our website. That's all they, and it's just B2B. It's not easy customers to access. This is like a B2B business that we're doing, but it works really, really well.
Amazing. I know you said earlier that like one of the things or lessons learned and mistakes was that you would have hired a CMO earlier, and that's what something you would have done differently. But so you can't say that again on this answer then. So from knowing what you know now and building a 100 million ARR business, like what one thing would you do or not do again, do differently or not do again?
Like I think a lot of entrepreneurs have this mindset of micromanaging because you're so involved in the detail from day one. And I didn't recognize when I was drowning because of my micromanagement tendencies. And I had a coach a few years ago who made me very aware of this. And now I'm hyper aware when I recognize when I'm micro, because at some point you become a manager of managers and you just cannot be quality assuring the system anymore. And I miss it because I'm really good at it, but it's a waste of my talent. And it's recognizing at which point of your journey you're a manager of managers and to pull away from those entrepreneurial tendencies, which is micromanagement effectively. And I think that was a real moment that I waited too long and it caused a lot of friction in our teams. And often what would happen is if I didn't get a report with a leader, I'm like, right, I think I have no trust. And I start micromanaging that department. And my coach is like, you know, you see what you're doing. You're working out that leader and you're not setting them up for success. Pull away from it and call them and saying, right, I recognize that I'm micromanaging and that's a bad behavior. What can you do to improve this relationship so that you give me information that calms me down? And that has been a transformational moment in my personal development.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing those things. We're going to move into the quickish fire round now. So what one thing has moved the needle the most for you in your career?
Growth mindset. Really, really constantly allowing myself to be really uncomfortable.
What's the best advice you've ever received?
I don't believe in advice. I listen to it all. And then I do the thing that I know is right for my business because no one understands my business. So listen to the advice and then do your own thing.
What about the biggest failure you've made and lesson learned?
I'd say in hindsight, I don't have a very balanced work life and it impacted my social life. And I don't yet know how to recover my social life, but that's definitely one of the areas that I'm failing in.
Yeah, Matt disappeared and you know, then nobody's responding on WhatsApp anymore. But hopefully it will recover. Hardest thing about being a CEO?
It's that you make a choice to live a certain life. And once you commit to that role, it does destroy parts of your social life. And it's incredibly rewarding. I love the growth mindset I have. But if you find me at 7 o'clock at night at the dinner table, I'm a zombie and my husband doesn't get value out of that. So I have to really switch off in the weekend. So I give time back to him as well and that we have fun.
Yeah, I mean, similar. And I think there's probably a lot of nodding heads listening to this as well. I think, you know, I generally work 9 till 6, 5 days a week. By 7 o'clock, I'm a zombie. My brain is just kind of fried. And then on the weekends, I don't want to do anything, right? I mean, I need to kind of hang out with my kids and kind of give them back some time. But I can't really socialize with my friends and I don't want to actually. I've got this feeling like I don't want to go out. Like I know everybody's going out and doing this thing. No interest. I just want to relax and just recharge so I'm ready for Monday. I think like I am becoming a lot more absent with friends, but I'm actually fine with that as well. Do you have a favorite business or book on business and what is it?
No, not a favorite. I think it's just keep reading. I think that's the biggest thing. Like now I'm reading about these Navy SEALs and extreme ownership because I'm like, that's an issue that we're dealing with in our business. So right now that's the one I'm reading. Is it my favorite book? No, I don't really like reading about Navy SEALs, but it's in the moments of what's happening in Muse, it's really relevant. So I always pick a book that's relevant to the challenge that I'm facing.
Is that the Jocko Willink one or is it another?
Yes, it is. Yes.
It is. Not bad. Where I think that was a quick fire round. Congrats on passing that. Matt, also congrats on being Europe's latest, maybe only unicorn in 2024, but I doubt that will be the case. Hopefully there'll be many more.
I hope not. Yeah. It'll be a depressing picture.
It would be. It would be. Where can people find you if they wanted to reach out, ask any questions, and where can they find Muse online?
So go on LinkedIn. Like, if you follow me, I am active. Like, so I have a very strong voice on topics that I care deeply about. So LinkedIn is the best place to find me. Muse.com. Like, we were able to buy that domain. It took us a few years to convince there was a restaurant in Maine that had that domain. And we literally had to go to this restaurant and fly there and offer them a lot of cash to get a domain. But we finally own it. So Muse.com.
Can you share how much you offered them?
200K, which at that time was a big spend for us.
Yeah, no, definitely. Well done on getting that and everything that you've built and will continue to build, going against against the grain of the difficult market and finding that growth. So a real achievement. So Matt Well, CEO and co-founder of Muse, thank you so much for joining the SaaS Revolution Show and sharing with the SaaS.com community.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the SaaS Revolution Show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you learned something from it, check out saasdoc.com/events to find all the upcoming SaaSdoc conferences around the world. Want exclusive SaaS content and actionable insights to grow your SaaS? Join our community of over 36,000 SaaS founders at saasdoc.com.